There's a kind of tortoise that might make use of a modern-day ark, the plowshare tortoise from Madagascar. Only a few hundred are still believed to exist. For years, the nonprofit group the Turtle Conservancy has battled against smugglers who sell them on the black market as pets. Reporter Gloria Hillard paid a visit to the Turtle Conservancy's facility in Ojai, California.
The hundreds of animals, large and small, residing at this well-guarded botanical oasis are a very quiet bunch. They have been brought here from countries around the world, like modern-day refugees escaping certain and continuing perils.
Turtles and tortoises are arguably the most threatened group of animals on the planet because out of the 330 species of turtles and tortoises, over half of them are threatened with extinction.
Eric Good is the founder of the Turtle Conservancy. He purchased this land in California's Ojai Valley 8 years ago, transforming it into a lush safe haven and breeding facility for some of the most endangered of Earth's creatures, threatened by hunters, habitat destruction, and now a booming global wildlife trade.
In Southeast Asia in particular, the newfound wealth in the middle class enables people to now buy animals and keep them as status symbols. And so this is happening in China, in Indonesia.
One of the most coveted of living status symbols is the plowshare tortoise. On the black market, they can fetch tens of thousands of dollars each. If you were to hold an adult one in your hands, they are maybe the size of a basketball. Two of them slowly meander toward veterinarian Paul Gibbons, their rounded feet lightly touching the earth like a ballet dancer on tiptoe.
We're looking at a tortoise that's incredibly beautiful with its golden shell and this rounded dome.
And carved into the back of the 30-pound female plowshare are four large numbers, 7002 and two block letters, M.G. The engraving, Gibbons says, is a last-ditch effort to save the species by making the tortoise less desirable to poachers and wealthy collectors.
And then we want the hobbyist or the pet owner to think, I'm looking for a beautiful tortoise, one that's not damaged.
The engraving is being done not only on those in the captive breeding program, but the few hundred remaining in the wild. Gibbons says the procedure does not appear to be a painful one for the tortoise, and the wearing down of the shell is part of the aging process. But less certain are the long-term effects.
In this case, it's clear that we are balancing some harm with the benefit to the species and the individual.
There are currently 11 plowshare tortoises at the sanctuary, but they are hoping that number goes up. Gibbons points to a plowshare nestled next to a large rock, a female.
She has mated with the male, and the eggs now are 2.5 months old. We're seeing signs that we believe there's a chance they might be fertile, but we're not certain yet.
Nothing would make Turtle Conservancy's Eric Good happier than welcoming captive-bred plowshare hatchlings into the world.
On one hand, tortoises have lived for over 250 million years. They've outlived the dinosaurs and they precede the dinosaurs. On the other hand, man is able to exterminate them very, very quickly.
It is a mystery how they survived this long. They move so slowly, they can't run away. All they can do is calmly stare back at you through ancient eyes. For NPR News, I'm Gloria Hillard.
Somewhere inside the 1,500 pages of the latest spending bill, there's language continuing a very old law. It requires that a particular kind of Pennsylvania coal be sent by rail and ship and barge all the way to Germany and all a taxpayer expense. It's what they call an earmark, one of those special requirements that members of Congress tuck into appropriations bills. This particular earmark is actually old enough that the congressman who authored it died decades ago. NPR's S.V. Date explains.
On a cold winter's day, one whole ocean and one half a continent away, this is the warm sound of home. Heated water flows through radiators in Kaiserslautern, Germany, the largest American military installation outside the United States. The hot water is piped from the city's power plant, and that power plant generates it by burning Pennsylvania anthracite. It's not an easy journey from Schuylkill County in northeastern Pennsylvania. The coal's taken out of the ground here, in Tamaqua, an old mining town nestled among the Appalachian Mountains. It's put on rail cars and shipped to an East Coast port, Baltimore nowadays. Uschi Herman is a civilian contracting officer for the Air Force in Germany. She monitors the coal contract with the city-owned utility that runs the power plant.
This is shipped from the States with a barge on the Rhine River and delivered to Rheinau. They have a storage area there, and they pick up the coal as they need it.
But hold on, there's plenty of coal to be had right in Europe, for much cheaper and without all the shipping costs. So why haul Pennsylvania coal to burn it in Germany?
We have approximately 70% generated from U.S. anthracite coal. So we can say approximately 9,000 tons under the contract.
Ah, yes, the contract, the result of that old earmark. It calls for American anthracite, which is produced only in eastern Pennsylvania. Jim Dyer is a lobbyist who spent decades working at the House Appropriations Committee. He began his career with a Pennsylvania congressman in the 1970s, back at a time more and more utilities were switching to oil or natural gas instead of coal.
The industry was struggling, and the Pennsylvania delegation wanted to do something to help it, and the one way it could help it was to get the federal government interested in buying some of it.
Congress didn't suggest an interest in Pennsylvania coal. It mandated one. The Defense Department began buying upwards of 1 million tons of anthracite a year. Soon enough, the Pentagon was complaining that it had no use for so much coal, that it had so much it was paving it over with asphalt to protect it from the elements, that it was far cheaper to buy electricity and heat from local communities. Over the years, those arguments swayed Congress. The million-ton mandate is down to those 9,000 tons still flowing to Kaiserslautern, Germany. Why? Again, longtime appropriations staffer Jim Dyer.
Someone must have requested that such provisions be continued.
Back in the 70s, that someone was Congressman Dan Flood. He left Congress in 1980, but one of his aides, Michael Clark, carried on, founding the Anthracite Industry Association to lobby Congress to keep the coal language. Today, Clark is still a lobbyist. His sole client, that German power company that is required to burn American anthracite. It's paid him about $250,000 a year over the last decade. He declined to be interviewed for broadcast. For its part, the Air Force says that it follows the laws passed by Congress. The member of Congress who represents Pennsylvania anthracite country is Democrat Matt Cartwright, who won the seat in 2012 running as an environmentalist. We caught up with him recently at a public hearing he was hosting in Wilkes-Barre. He acknowledges that the coal program is not ideal from an environmental standpoint, but
it's one of those things in Washington that if you want to dislodge it, you have to well up a force of steam to get that done. I'm not aware of any great groundswell of support to get rid of it at this point.
And Cartwright says he's not ready to lead the charge to eliminate policy that's nearly a half century old.
Before you dislodge a tradition like that, you want to study it closely.
This past December, the Air Force signed a 6-year extension of its heating contract for Kaiserslautern, including the requirement that it continue burning American anthracite. Esfi Date, NPR News.
Today we're kicking off a special NPR series, marking the 25th anniversary of the disaster. The environmental damage at the time was horrendous, but many scientists thought it would be short-lived. Instead, it stretched out for many years. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that 25 years of research has now led to some startling conclusions about oil's persistent effects.
Cordova, Alaska was the closest fishing village to the spill. Since then, it's become a hub for scientists. Researchers recently gathered in the town's library to talk about herring. It was the herring that tipped off scientists that oil's effects were more complicated than they imagined. Here's what happened. Herring were spawning at the time of the spill. None of those herring eggs survived. But a year later, the herring population seemed to bounce back.
That was the nature of oil spills. Studied them for 1 or 2 years. When things are back on track, you walked away.
Jeep Rice from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says herring seemed to match that conventional wisdom.
So we walked away from herring, and all of a sudden, crash to the bottom of the floor, and then we're scrambling trying to figure out why.
In addition to the herring population crashing, other animals also unexpectedly suffered for years. Killer whales, sea otters, harlequin ducks. It seemed it didn't take much oil to do a lot of damage, and do it in different ways. For example, oil under rocks and in sediments, contaminated clams that sea otters ate. It didn't kill the otters outright. Dan Essler is with the U.S. Geological Survey. He says it shortened their lives and suppressed the population for 20 years.
The understanding that lingering oil could have chronic effects on wildlife populations was a new and important finding, and one that we did not anticipate at the time that we started the research.
Then there was another unexpected effect on fish eggs. The clue came from pink salmon, which weren't doing well, even years after the spill. To figure that out, Noah's Jeep Rice's team exposed pink salmon embryos to tiny amounts of oil.
We were dosing them with oil that you couldn't see, couldn't smell. But we were doing it for a long time, and 6 months later, you know, they had abnormalities, and, you know, kind of, wow.
The substances responsible were polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that are found in oil. Scientists hadn't realized they are toxic to aquatic life. They discovered these compounds persist long after other parts of oil evaporate. It took years to figure all this out. But still, no one knew how the oil was damaging the animals over the long term. One possibility was fish hearts. It's one of the first things that develops in a fish embryo. Another NOAA scientist, John Incardona, tried a novel experiment with fish.
We put them on a treadmill, in essence, for fish, a swim tunnel, and tested how fast they could swim for a prolonged period. And the oil-exposed ones couldn't swim as fast for long. We found that the shape of their hearts were different.
Okay. So now they had a good idea what organ was harmed, but they still didn't know what the mechanism was. Then came the spring of 2010 and the big BP oil spill into the Gulf of Mexico. Scientists focused on fish likely to be spawning, such as the bluefin tuna. Barbara Block is a marine biologist at Stanford University who studies tuna. She feared the BP spill, like the Exxon Valdez, could have long-term effects.
Survivorship of the eggs are critical for future generations, especially on a severely depleted population of the bluefin that breed in the Gulf of Mexico.
Block collaborated with the NOAA scientists to answer a question that still puzzled them.
What would cause a fish heart to slow down?
They showed that oil interrupts the electrical signals that are essential for fish hearts to beat effectively. So far, they think this can happen to embryos or young fish.
What we're doing is applying the science of the Exxon Valdez and taking it into 21st century methodologies.
It's like a coroner pinning down a mysterious cause of death, but taking 25 years to do it. And as in a criminal case, this knowledge could give scientists evidence to hold companies responsible for long-term damages no one ever knew oil spills were causing. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Cleanup crews are working this morning to contain as much as 168,000 gallons of oil that spilled into Galveston Bay over the weekend after a barge ran into another ship in the Houston Ship Channel in Texas. The accident happened just 2 days before the anniversary of America's most famous oil spill. It was 25 years ago today that the Exxon Valdez ran aground in Prince William Sound in Alaska. This week, NPR is exploring the legacy of that environmental and economic disaster. And today, NPR's Debbie Elliott takes us to a remote fishing town thrown into disarray by the spill.
Oh, here's a really good gust.
It's a blustery, snowy March day when Michelle Hahn O'Leary offers a tour of Cordova, Alaska, starting at the fishing harbor.
We're on Orca Inlet, which is the bay right in front of Cordova, and we're driving in front of a lot of the canneries.
Commercial fishing is the lifeblood of this town of 2200, situated on the eastern shore of Prince William Sound. Back in 1989, O'Leary and her late husband were preparing for the spring herring season when everything changed in the early morning hours of March 24th.
It's Valdez back.
Captain Joe Hazelwood's call to the Coast Guard just after midnight. Leaking some oil, the ruptured tanker oozed 11 million gallons of crude into Prince William Sound.
Just felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. This was one of those turning points in life where you measure things before and after.
O'Leary has never fished since. Native Alaskan Tom Anderson no longer makes his living from the sea either.
You can't fix it. Once you break that egg sometimes, that's it.
Anderson says the waters here have sustained his people, the Chugach, for generations. The 71-year-old commercial fisherman now picks up odd construction jobs, hanging drywall. A whole way of living has been changed, he says, making a wiping motion with his arm.
You pretty much lived there. You got your clams and crabs and fish, and it was, you're at home, you know. And then somebody come and dumped oil all over it. That's really hitting home.
Because the oil company and government agencies were ill-prepared to respond, oil from the Exxon Valdez stretched for 11,000 square miles, fouling beaches, destroying fisheries, and killing hundreds of thousands of birds and all kinds of sea life, including whales and sea otters. Exxon eventually set up a voluntary program to compensate oil spill victims and hired local fishermen for the cleanup. Anderson worked a sea otter rescue crew.
It didn't take us long. You could smell it before you ever saw it.
He says Prince William Sound was silenced.
There was no fish, no birds chasing fish. You could sit there and it would just be dead quiet. So everybody called it the dead zone.
The disaster upended life in Cordova for years. Fishermen were docked. Businesses went bankrupt. Drug and alcohol abuse went up, along with reports of domestic violence and depression. The mayor committed suicide. Those paid by Exxon to work the cleanup were jealously labeled spillionaires. Patience Anderson Faulkner, Tom Anderson's sister, says this once close-knit community changed.
You couldn't look at your neighbor to help you. You didn't trust your neighbor. You didn't trust your brother. It was very, very sad.
Faulkner is now part of a citizens' advisory council put in place to monitor the recovery and readiness for another oil spill. The panel is still tracking lingering oil from the Exxon Valdez.
Welcome aboard. Watch your step.
Dave Janka captains the Auklet, a 58-foot wooden boat he uses for private charters. Most clients are scientists studying the oil spill's impact. Along the way, he's collected his own samples. He opens a jar labeled February 19th of this year.
Looks like oil, smells like oil. It's oil.
Oh, yeah. That's like what you smell in your hand after you pump gas.
Yeah.
He collected the dark black oily water mixture from Eleanor Island in Prince William Sound, digging down about 6 inches beneath the rocky shoreline.
If you or I in our backyard or at our mom and pop gas station had a fuel tank leak, we would be held to the point of bankruptcy to clean that up.
Exxon, now ExxonMobil Corporation, spent a total of $4.3 billion in cleanup costs, legal damages, settlements, and fines. ExxonMobil spokesman Richard Keel says the company regrets the incident took place.
Without doubt, it was a tragic event, but it's something that we have learned from, and we live those lessons each and every day.
A class action lawsuit wasn't resolved until 2008, when the U.S. Supreme Court slashed a $5 billion jury award to just over $500 million, plus nearly that much in interest. Fisherman and former Cordova mayor Jim Kalander does not blame Exxon for mounting a defense.
We all need oil. Accidents are going to happen.
But, he says, after 19 years of drawn-out litigation, the final Supreme Court verdict was the hardest blow.
Justice was not served. All my life I'd been brought up to think that, you get to the Supreme Court and everything's made right. People are made whole. Issues are corrected. And I'm still disappointed. I'll never get over it.
Kalander says now, 25 years later, the town of Cordova has nearly come full circle, even if the environmental recovery is incomplete. A killer whale pod in Prince William Sound is near extinction, and the local herring fishery isn't back. But the harbor is bustling again, with a fishing fleet getting ready to harvest salmon, halibut, and cod. Kalander's boat, the Miss Emily, is now part of a standby fleet ready to respond to oil spills.
We have to be fueled up and watered up and have groceries on board, be ready to go 24/7.
Back out at Orca Inlet, Michelle O'Leary warns even with a new readiness, the lesson from Exxon Valdez is that there's no way to put the oil back once it spills.
Right now we've got one of the safest ports in the world, and we've got one of the best oil spill response plans, but the weather we're having today, nothing could be done, absolutely nothing.
She's talking about the winds that are gusting to 60 miles an hour. Winds that canceled a planned oil spill response drill. Dispersants wouldn't work in these conditions, O'Leary says, and the oil would be nearly impossible to contain. Here in Alaska, the best laid plans are still at the mercy of Mother Nature. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Today on All Things Considered, we'll ask if the nation is prepared for the next big oil spill. And you can get a picture of Alaska on NPR's On the Road Tumblr account. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
Russian forces have now seized the airbase at Belbek, one of the last military installations in Crimea, previously under Ukrainian control. NPR's Gregory Warner is there, and we'll have the latest on that in a little while. But first, a radio transmission from March 24, 1989, to the Vessel Traffic Center in Valdez, Alaska, just after midnight. We're leaking some oil. That's Captain Joseph Hazelwood, casually announcing one of the worst environmental disasters the U.S. had ever seen. The supertanker he commanded, the Exxon Valdez, had just run aground in a reef off the coast of Alaska. An estimated 11 million gallons of crude oil gushed into Prince William Sound. Back then, NPR's Peter Kenyon was reporting for Alaska Public Radio.
By this afternoon, the slick had been blown clear across to beaches on the far side of Prince William Sound. Some islands were completely surrounded by oil.
Response vessels weren't prepared for the scale of the disaster, and strong winds and choppy seas overwhelmed any attempts to clean up the thick, black oil that coated the shores. Rupert Cutler, then with the Wilderness Society, told NPR that he wasn't surprised by what had happened.
With the rocks and the reefs, the fog, the icebergs, and now, of course, it appears that there was negligence involved, with the skipper being down below and an unqualified third mate at the helm.
John Devins was mayor of Valdez. He said the future of the entire region was at stake.
Cordova and Tetitlik and possibly even Whittier are faced with the destruction of our entire way of life.
Don Cornett, an Exxon executive, tried a different spin with local citizens worried about the extinction of the fishing industry.
You have Exxon, and we do business straight. We will consider whatever it takes to keep you whole.
After years of litigation, $2.5 billion in punitive damages was awarded to those harmed by the spill. The Supreme Court later reduced that to $500 million. While Alaska studies the long-term effects of oil exposure on fish, in Ecuador, they're worried about the human population. Texaco, now owned by Chevron, was drilling in the town of Lago Agrio until 1992. The residents say the company left behind billions of gallons of toxic waste. Reporter Adam Klasfeld has been following the case for Courthouse News and is reporting in Ecuador right now. He says the lingering effects of the oil are still obvious.
It's very easy to see, and it's very easy to smell. You can smell it in the soils. You can smell it even in the fruits.
I spoke with a man, Manuel Salinas. He's a 78-year-old man, and he inspired a 2007 relocation initiative. He says he's had stomach pains for 8 years. He talks about that he didn't have money for a wheelchair, and it amazed me that a man who inspired this presidential initiative can't even afford a wheelchair now.
The mostly indigenous communities there complain of high rates of cancer, but establishing cause and effect in this region is not easy.
I spoke to one man, Alejandro Soto. His father, brother, and niece all died of cancer. His niece died of leukemia, which is traced to a toxin called benzene. Even Chevron acknowledges benzene is linked to cancer. And here's the wrinkle in this. There are terrible medical records in the area, and the Lago Agrio plaintiffs have never been able to provide documentation that this person died of cancer for this reason. Chevron says that's because there is no link, and the afectados and their lawyers say that there's the stories that are all around the region are evidence of that, and there's a battle of statistics. The statistics that you hear from the Lago Agrio plaintiffs, a man named Miguel San Sebastian and his study found elevated rates. Chevron's expert, who they funded, found opposite.
The people affected by the oil contamination have come to be known as afectados, the affected. Their court battle with the oil company began in 1993 and continues to this day. The Exxon Valdez case took years to settle, and that only involved one country. In Lago Agrio, things are much more complicated. Because Chevron has virtually no assets in Ecuador, the residents have taken the case international. It has drawn in judges and litigators in Ecuador, the United States, Canada, and the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague. The original offender, Texaco, no longer exists, so the afectados and their lawyers have sued the company that absorbed it, Chevron. They've gone after Chevron's assets in other countries, drawing in more lawyers.
Every small point is being litigated and appealed from dozens of courts around the world. And now there's a litigation at The Hague between the Ecuadorian government and Chevron. This is a case simultaneously being fought on three continents with developments that spiral day by day.
This month, a U.S. judge overturned a $9.5 billion settlement, not because the afectados had failed to prove the damages caused by the oil, but because of massive corruption on the part of one of the lead lawyers for the afectados. Adam Klasfeld has tracked the reaction across Ecuador.
The official reaction has been a number of sharp words. President Correa has described the ruling a number of times as imperialism, and he asked essentially what would the U.S. reaction be if an Ecuadorian court of law declared a U.S. verdict fraudulent and illegitimate.
Klasfeld says that for Chevron, the case has huge implications. Having indigenous communities sue a multinational corporation and actually win could set a dangerous precedent, basically a major disincentive for oil exploration in countries that are thought to have imperfect judicial systems. And with no resolution in sight, Klasfeld says the only thing that's certain is that Chevron will continue to fight this tooth and nail, and so will the afectados.